Well, I'm very, very pleased indeed to welcome Gopal Gupta, who's going to talk to us this afternoon. Gopal did an undergraduate degree in the States, and then he did the MPhil in Science and Religion here, and now he's doing a DPhil in the Theology Faculty on Yoga and Maya. And he's working very hard at the moment on this thesis, and he's meticulously gone through the text, looking at the usages of the terms Maya, and he's going to share with us his thoughts and findings now. So over to you, Gopal. Yoga and Maya in the Bhagavata Purana.
Thank you very much, Gavin. I'm very glad to be here today. Like Gavin said, this is a wonderful opportunity for me to present part of my work and receive some feedback from all of you. My thesis is on the concept of Maya in the Bhagavata Purana. But in the course of my studies, in the course of studying Maya, I found that the concept of Maya is very closely related to yoga in the Bhagavata as well, because the Bhagavata uses the term yoga Maya very frequently. Maya itself is a very, you could say, very common term, and found throughout Indian philosophies and Indian texts. It's a term like yoga and karma that's pretty much found everywhere in Sanskrit literature. And there is actually some academic work done on Maya, but that work primarily focuses on how Maya has been used in Vedanta, and mainly in Advaita Vedanta, in Shankara's usage of Maya. And so Maya has been understood commonly as illusion, as unreality, as bewilderment. And so these are the general impressions in academia and in general that people carry about the meaning of Maya. And the reason I was interested in studying it is because Maya itself is a very complex term. And we find Maya's first used in the Vedas, then in the Upanishads, and then the Puranas. And throughout these different texts, it takes upon a very wide variety of meanings. So the other uses of Maya, you could say the Vedic usage, the Puranic usage, have not been studied. And there's essentially no scholarship on Maya in its various different senses. Quite interestingly, in the Upanishads, we find the term Maya used only 4 or 5 times in the entire, you could say, primary principle Upanishads. But then in the Puranas, we find a sudden explosion of the usage of the term, where in the Bhagavata alone, the term Maya is used more than 1,000 times. So that's another thing that I argue in my thesis, is that Maya is actually... It's primarily a Puranic concept more than an Upanishadic concept, which is again something which is not well known in scholarship. So I particularly chose to work on the Bhagavata Purana, because in the entire Puranic literature, the Bhagavata is the most popular and widely read and widely used in Indian culture and traditions, you could say. While most Puranas don't have any commentaries, or they might have 1 or 2 commentaries, the Bhagavata alone has over 81 extant commentaries, meaning commentaries that we still have today and that people can read. And then there's many more that are listed, but they're no longer extant. So it has the most number of commentaries. The Bhagavata has also produced more poetry, literature, art, drama in popular culture than possibly any other Indian work, with the possible exception of the Ramayana. So the Bhagavata is a nice Purana to use to study how this concept was used in this time period. And also the Bhagavata, as we will see, it has a very developed concept of Maya. It uses Maya in ways that are quite unique and original to the text. So just as a side note, the the famous Sanskritist Daniel Ingalls. He called Maya one of the most beautiful concepts in the history of religious studies. So hopefully through my paper I can try to illustrate that. So in this paper, like I said, I'll be looking at the relationship between yoga and Maya in the Bhagavata Purana. So I'll read for about 45 minutes, and then after that we'll open it up for discussion and comments. Being a rather late arrival on the religious landscape of India, 4th to 9th century CE, the Bhagavata was written after the compilation of the Vedas, Brahmanas, Upanishads, Mahabharata, Ramayana, Harivamsa, and the main texts of the six philosophical darshans. Although the Bhagavata developed from a complex set of religious influences, the Purana has been particularly noted for its very deliberate and explicit association with the Mahabharata. Nicholas Sutton has shown that although the Mahabharata adheres to the Vedic worldview and is primarily concerned with the subtleties of Dharma, it also presents new systems of thought which eventually become classified as Sankhya, Vedanta, Yoga, and Bhakti. These systems then receive further development in Puranic literature. The Bhagavata, being an unambiguously Vaishnava Purana, exemplifies and develops a discourse on Bhakti. In his book Viraha Bhakti, Freedom Hardy shows that the Bhagavata presents two distinct types of bhakti. A normative bhakti, which he describes as quiet contemplation, and an intensely emotional bhakti directed towards Krishna. Hardy points out that while normative bhakti is found in the Bhagavad Gita, and consequently the Mahabharata, the emotional bhakti of the Bhagavata is not. Thomas Hopkins concurs, quote, "Such devotion of the Bhagavata represents a significant change from the bhakti of the Bhagavad Gita. For the bhakti must be more than quiet contemplation. It must be a transfer to the Lord of all emotions and desires that are ordinarily expended on the world and its pleasures. Bhakti without emotional fervor cannot purify." Unquote. Hardy credits the development of emotional bhakti to many factors, especially to the South Indian Tamil poets, the Alvars. But he also points out that the Bhagavata is the earliest Sanskrit text to illustrate emotional bhakti in a developed and cohesive form. The Bhagavata's bhakti causes bristling of the hair of the body, tears of joy, and singing and dancing, and is exemplified by important Vaishnava role models such as Prahlad, Dhruva, Bali, Gajendra, and Ambarisha. Furthermore, in the 10th book, the Bhagavata introduces the reader to a bhakti wherein the devotee forgets Krishna's divinity and considers the Lord his or her child, friend, or lover. The text makes clear that this emotional bhakti is the highest attainment available to any living being and is possessed by only the most exalted Bhagavatas, such as the gopis, the coward maidens of Vrindavan. In this paper, I will argue that the shift from the normative bhakti of the Mahabharata to the emotional bhakti of the Bhagavata is made possible primarily through the concept of yoga maya. I will examine the relationship between yoga, the yogi, yoga maya, and yogeshwara in the two texts, and show that without maya, the intensity of the emotional connection between the devotee and Krishna found in the Bhagavata cannot take place. While non-dualist Vedanta philosophy often sees Maya as a negative force, I will argue that the Bhagavata affirms just the opposite. The devotee's place under the veil of Maya is a desirable situation, for it allows for the experience of intimate love between Krishna and his devotee. As a converse counterpart to the Mahabharata, the Bhagavata accepts the Mahabharata's ideas of Maya, yoga, and yoga maya, but then refines and expands these ideas in terms of emotional bhakti. Thus, before we dive into the Bhagavata, it will be necessary to at least briefly study the epic's conception of yoga and maya and the relationship between them. So this is then yoga maya in the Mahabharata. Actually, interestingly, the Bhagavata actually starts towards the end of the Mahabharata. So you could say the final discussions and discourses in the Mahabharata are the starting point of the Bhagavata. So it really conscientiously reflects upon the Mahabharata, because the Mahabharata is sort of like bad memories for the Bhagavata. This big battle has happened, all these people died, and no one could really figure out what dharma was, what was not dharma, or they were struggling with that issue. And so in its discourse, the Bhagavata is conscientiously trying to resolve some of these issues within its text. Scholars generally derive maya from the verbal root ma, meaning to make or to create. Honda, Monier Williams, and P.D. Shastri regard this meaning as a specification of the general meaning of ma, to measure. According to this derivation, maya becomes that by which a thing is measured, miyate anaya iti, thus tying closely with an Advaita understanding of maya. That elusive projection of the world by which the immeasurable Brahman appears as if measured. This is no doubt a later etymology of the word, as the earliest usage of maya in the Rig Veda is in connection with making or creating. O'Flaherty points out that maya creates things as a mother would do. The Sanskrit word for mother, matur, is derived from the same root. Burrow has argued that there is no etymological link between ma to measure and ma to make, the latter descending from an altogether different Indo-European root, ma meaning to make. The term maya, as used in the Vedas, primarily refers to the mysterious, awesome, and wonder-working power which creates effects that transcend human understanding. In the Veda, maya is found in the ritual and fire. In Rig Vedic hymns, the earthly sacrificer gains possession of maya as a result of the ritual, and in turn maya gives its possessor control over others. Interestingly, Sayana, in his commentary on the Veda, explains the word mayaya, instrumental singular of maya, as karma vishaya bhijyanena, by knowledge of sacrificial rites. According to Sayana, maya is synonymous with the knowledge of sacrificial rites, because it is the performance of sacrificial rites that brings about maya. Agni, the fire god, is given special significance, for it is in him that all the mayas of the sacrifice are brought together. Agni and Soma receive the epithet mayin, or mayavan, possessor of maya, and so also do persons who produce Agni or Soma, namely the earthly sacrificers. So, in the Veda, maya is mainly as magic. It's the magic of individuals, of the gods, and of humans. And maya still hasn't become a cosmic power. It's not a unified cosmic power of a cosmic deity. Maya is localized, and maya as a power is produced from the performance of yajna, or sacrifice. So Agni is seen as a personification of maya, and those who ignite the Agni, the sacrificers, they become the possessors of maya, because it's through sacrifice that people gain powers. So maya is mainly possessed by the gods, like Indra, Agni, Soma, Varuna, like these gods. In the Mahabharata, however, maya is primarily found not in ritual, but rather in the practice of yoga, yoga maya. Maya is produced from yoga, and the greater one's yogic perfection, the greater the possession of maya. In order to ascertain the Mahabharata's conception of yoga maya, it will be useful to first examine the text's understanding of yoga. The word yoga is often derived from the root yuj, meaning to connect, yoke, or control. The word carries this sense in the Rig Veda, when a seer asks who knows the yoga connection between the words of a verse. In the Atharva Veda, the word describes a plough that connects or controls multiple bullocks. Similarly, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, we find the term Ratha Yoga, which denotes the chariot yoke of the horses. In all these instances, yoga refers to the connecting tool. So, at this point, it's just it's a word that refers to something that connects two things together. and it's not related to meditation or to meditative practices. K.S. Joshi believes that connect or control is perhaps the oldest meaning of the term yoga. Although we find some descriptions of meditative practices in the Veda, the term yoga is not used in reference to these practices. We find examples of Vedic seers aspiring to reach the heavens, or even for attaining Brahman through dhyana, diksha, and tapas, but these practices are in more or less fluid form. Only in later texts, when these and other meditative practices have been formalized, do they become associated with the word yoga. The Bhagavad Gita in particular uses yoga in two different ways. Yoga most often refers to a system or method of action. In the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna defines yoga as skill in action, yoga karmasu kaushalam. Yoga often involves controlling the senses or mind and focusing them properly. Drawing upon Vedic imagery, the Mahabharata compares the senses to horses and bulls. Just as bulls are yoked by a plow and horses are controlled by a chariot, the senses are to be controlled by yoga. As a rider can go on his way comfortably if the horse is well within his control, the Mahabharata reasons, one can go through life comfortably if the senses are controlled. The second way in which the Gita defines yoga is not as a system or method of practice, but rather as a result of that practice. In other words, once the senses are controlled by yoga, one attains the state of yoga. The Gita describes this state as equipoise, samatva, steadiness even in the midst of greatest suffering, sthithona dukhena gurunapi vichalyate, and being situated in Brahman, Brahmabhuta. Thus, yoga in the Gita is both the means and the end, the method and result of controlling the senses. But this is not all. There is another key purpose of yoga in the epic. We often find yogis and warriors performing extreme yogic practice to gain control over Maya for use in warfare and other mundane pursuits. This use of yoga, as Eve Frauwaller notes, is clearly distinct from the practice of yoga as part of the quest for salvation. Sutton notes that in the Mahabharata, yoga is as much a means of gaining control over magical power as it is a means for liberation. In fact, the didactic passages of the Mahabharata that present yoga primarily for its soteriological purpose warn the yogi not to be distracted by magical powers that come as a byproduct of yogic practice. The supernatural powers that result from a successful yogi's conquest of nature are called vibhuti, siddhi, or maya. Indeed, the Mahabharata is not unique in its understanding of the relationship between yoga and maya. The third chapter of Patanjali's Yoga Sutra, entitled Vibhuti Yoga, elaborately describes powers gained through yoga and warns its readers not to be distracted by them. Throughout the Mahabharata, Maya often refers to the wonderful, deceitful, or elusive power which some human, god, or demon amasses by the practice of yoga and then uses to fight his opponent in battle. So, yoga has a soteriological purpose, or a purpose for liberation, for attaining Brahman. But then yoga also has this aspect of, it's a practice by which one gains mystical power. And that can be as mundane as power to use in the battle, to fight an opponent. So, there's many examples of this in the Mahabharata. Both the Pandavas, the one side, and the Kauravas, the other side of this battle, the heads of them, both like Yudhishthira and Duryodhan, they're all accomplished yogins, it's described. They've done immense amounts of meditation and they've amassed great powers. And so part of the warfare is magical powers. It includes Maya. So at the end, when Duryodhan is left with nothing and he's all alone, he hides in a lake and he makes the waters of that lake solid, it said, by his powers of Maya, by his yoga Maya. And then Krishna asks Yudhishthira to essentially make that lake back into water using his powers of Maya. So, and whoever has the greatest yoga, whoever's done the greatest amount of yoga, will have the greatest amount of Maya and will able to supersede the other person's Maya. So that's why in the Mahabharata and in these texts in general, they have to be careful with the brahmanas, and especially those brahmanas that participate in the battle, because they've apparently done the most amount of yoga. So their Maya power, their Mayic power is the best or the greatest. Jayadrath, for example, practices harsh yogic austerities to gain powers to bring grief to the Pandavas. By these powers, Jayadrath is able to defeat the Pandavas and become the cause of death for Abhimanyu, Arjuna's son. However, because of help from Krishna, who is the master of yoga, Yogeshwara, and thus the supreme Mayin, Arjuna is able to overcome Jayadrath's yogic power and kill him. Thus, in the epic, Maya is produced from yoga and is itself a neutral force, but has good or evil consequences depending on who uses it. In the Bhagavad Gita in particular, we find that Yoga Maya is not simply the localized power of a god or human, but rather the cosmic power of an all-powerful individual, Krishna, whom the Gita calls the master of yoga, Yogeshwara. So this is probably the first instance in historically in terms of the text where Maya becomes, the Mahabharata is the first place where Maya becomes a cosmic power, and it's referred to as the power of a cosmic divinity. The word Maya appears 6 times in the Gita and is used in 2 different ways. Let us look at each usage in turn. Firstly, Maya is the power by which Krishna manifests the world. In chapter 7, where we find half of all the instances of Maya, Krishna makes a famous statement to Arjuna: "For that which consists of the gunas is my elusive power, Maya, so difficult to cross beyond. Only those who offer themselves to me cross over this elusive power of Maya." According to Angelika Malinar, in this text, Maya is identified with Prakriti, consisting of the gunas. By identifying Maya with Prakriti, the text emphasizes Krishna's sovereignty over nature, Prakriti, as the master of yoga, Yogeshwara. So here we see again Maya and Prakriti. Actually, in the Shvetashvara Upanishad, we also find a similar identification of the two terms. Secondly, in the Bhagavad Gita, Maya is also the power by which Krishna bewilders the world and hides himself. Quote, "I am not revealed to everyone, being concealed by my divine power of yoga, Yoga Maya. This bewildered world does not recognize me as the unborn and ever-present." By his Yoga Maya, Krishna conceals himself from living beings who do not take refuge in him. At the same time, Maya is also the power by which Krishna reveals himself in the world. Sambhavami Atma Mayaya. Quote, "As the one without birth, the ever-present self, as the supreme lord of all beings presiding over my nature, I become manifest by Maya, the power of myself." So here we see 2 aspects. Maya has a concealing aspect, and also, so that you could say in some ways is a negative aspect, the concealing aspect, but then on the other side, Maya also has a revealing aspect. It's also the power that's used by Krishna to reveal himself in the world. The words used here are not Yoga Maya, but Atma Maya, the power of my own self, emphasizing that this power is possessed by and innate to Krishna. Thus, we have seen that the notion of Yoga Maya, Maya that is born from yoga, has deep roots in the Mahabharata. Although yoga also has a soteriological purpose, one of its main purposes in the epic is to harness Maya. Maya is possessed to limited degrees by yogis and warriors according to the level of their yogic perfection. Krishna is identified as Yogeshwara, the master of yoga, and thus he is also considered the supreme Mayin, who uses his Maya to create and bewilder all the worlds. In the following section, we will see how the Bhagavata Purana accepts the Mahabharata's understanding of Yoga Maya, but then modifies and expands it in its discourse of bhakti. So here there'll be a development The Bhagavata takes this basic framework of yoga and maya from the Mahabharata and then uses that in the context of its doctrine of bhakti. So now we move into the Bhagavata Purana. The term Yogamaya appears throughout the Bhagavata in over 50 verses. Although both the Mahabharata and the Purana agree that Maya is produced from Yoga, the primary role that Yogamaya plays in the Bhagavata is, as we will see, quite different. In this section, I will first examine the various uses of Yogamaya and the relationship between the terms Yoga, Yogamaya, and Maya in the Bhagavata. I will then discuss the unique role that Yogamaya plays in the Bhagavata's Rasa Lila chapters. I will argue that Yogamaya is not only born from yoga, but it also plays the essential role of intensifying the yogi's practice of yoga. In the Bhagavata, the term Yogamaya is used in almost all the same ways as the unqualified term Maya. Edwin Bryant, along with some scholars of the Bhagavata, such as Siddheshwara Bhattacharya, believe that in contrast to the term Maya, which is generally used in connection with the samsaric world, meaning it's just Maya in terms of illusion, in terms of the world of matter, the world composed of the gunas, Yoga Maya is a term that only occurs in the context of Krishna's Leela. This claim, however, is largely unfounded. Throughout the Bhagavata, the term Yoga Maya appears outside the context of Krishna's Leela. Like the unqualified Maya, Yoga Maya is often described as the causal power that creates the material world of earth, water, fire, etc., and that prevents living beings from realizing their true spiritual nature. For example, the 10th book describes Yoga Maya as the energy which manifests the gunas, known as sattva, rajas, and tamas, and deludes living beings. Indeed, Yoga Maya is even used in reference to the localized yogic power of gods and humans, such as Indra and Svayambhuva Manu. Just as the term Yoga Maya is used outside the context of Krishna's Leela, we also find that the unqualified term Maya is used in the context of Krishna's Leela. For example, both Maya and Yoga Maya are used in various places to refer to the power by which Krishna makes his human-like appearances, and by which he makes his family forget that he is God. Thus, unlike Bryant, Daniel Sheridan, Siddheshwara Bhattacharya, I would like to argue that there is no fundamental distinction between the terms Maya and Yoga Maya in the Bhagavata, because Maya is almost always generated from yoga. In the Bhagavata, the term Maya and Yoga Maya are synonymous, except in situations where Maya is not being used in the sense of power, but simply as trickery, deception, fraud, deceit, or art. It should also be noted that the Bhagavata itself states that Yoga Maya has many names, one of which is Maya. Before Krishna descends to earth, he tells Yoga Maya to go to earth, where she will be known by many names, such as Durga, Bhadrakali, Vijaya, Vaishnavi, Kamuda, and Maya. Why the Bhagavata uses Maya in some verses and Yoga Maya in others is not immediately evident. One simple reason may be that sometimes the bisyllabic word Maya fits the Sanskrit meter better than Yoga Maya, the full term with two words, or vice versa. Another reason may be that since Yoga Maya plays such an essential role in the Bhagavata and appears so often in the text, so the terms Maya or Yoga Maya appear over 1,000 times, the Purana uses the term Maya as an abbreviation. So, you know, in every verse you don't want to use Yoga Maya, you just say Maya for short. Thus, the Bhagavata and the Mahabharata both agree that Maya is produced from yoga, and they use the terms Maya and Yoga Maya interchangeably, except in situations where Maya does not refer to a power. However, because the Bhagavata has a unique understanding of yoga, Maya's function in the Purana is quite different than in the Mahabharata. Therefore, before we examine Yoga Maya's unique role in the Bhagavata, it is first necessary to briefly study the Bhagavata's conception of yoga. So both the Mahabharata and the Bhagavata are using the term Yoga Maya, but in between the shift in these two texts is that in the Bhagavata, the concept of yoga, its understanding of yoga, has changed dramatically. So that changes its concept of yoga maya. It influences its usage of yoga maya. So the yoga of the Rasa Lila. So for the purpose of this paper, it wasn't possible to look at all the aspects of yoga in the Bhagavata. So I'm focusing on the Rasa Lila section, which is a very central section of the Bhagavata. It's possibly been the most well studied also in scholarship. So and it's also in terms of the text itself, it's also in some ways a climax of the text. So if we so looking at this section is quite interesting for our purposes. The Bhagavata's discussion of yoga draws from the Mahabharata as well as standard yoga texts as Patanjali's Yoga Sutra. The Bhagavad Gita uses the term yoga to refer to a spiritual path or discipline, such as karma, jnana, or bhakti. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra gives a systematic presentation of yoga involving physical and mental techniques that free the Purusha from the 24 categories of prakriti. According to Daniel Sheridan, the Bhagavata's presentation of yoga draws on both traditions and at times mixes them. I will argue that the Bhagavata offers a unique form of yoga that is indebted to these earlier traditions, but is nevertheless distinct from them in an important way. The Bhagavata blends its characteristic emotional bhakti with the otherwise staid practice of yoga. In order to demonstrate this, I will focus mainly on the famous Rasa Lila narrative, which appears in the 10th book and is known as the Rasa Panchadhyaya. The Rasa Lila vividly illustrates the unique emotional bhakti of the Bhagavata. In 1920, J.N. Farquhar was possibly the first to observe that the Rasa Lila of the Bhagavata presents a new theory of bhakti, which is categorically distinct from all earlier literature. According to the Gita, an essential element for successful yoga practice is the control of desire or lust, kama. A yogi must completely give up desire because it is the all-consuming sinful enemy of the world. The Bhagavata also views desire as a major obstacle on the path of the yogi. The Bhagavata's yoga, however, prescribes controlling desire by rechanneling that desire toward Krishna. Narada explains this to Yudhishthira in the Bhagavata. Quote, "Many persons have attained connection, yoga, with the Supreme Lord after being purified of all their impiety by concentrating their mind on the Lord through lust, kama, hatred, dvesha, fear, bhaya, affection, sneha, and devotion, bhakti. The gopis through lust, Kansa through fear, Shishupal and other kings through hatred, Vrishnis through kinship, you Pandavas through friendship and affection, and we sages through devotion, attained connection with him, O King." So what's peculiar about the Bhagavata's yoga is that even Krishna's enemies attain perfection as a result of their yoga, which is their constant hatred for Krishna. So the essential idea behind the Bhagavata's yoga is that whatever the excuse may be, if the yogi somehow or other focuses his mind and connects, attaches his mind with the divinity, which is in some ways sattva, it's shuddha sattva, it's pure goodness. If the yogi attaches his mind, then that meditation purifies the yogi and purifies the senses of the yogi and leads to perfection. So this in some ways it ties in with the Bhagavata's cosmology, where the Bhagavata sees the world as composed of the gunas, which is composed of sattva, rajas, and tamas, and perfection is essentially putting your mind in a washing machine, where you purify the senses of the two lower modes, which is tamas and rajas, so that all that's left is sattva or shuddha sattva. So perfection is more a form of purification than you could say annihilation of the senses. It's attachment of the senses to Krishna. So the enemies of Krishna, they attain perfection through fear and hatred, and the gopis, they attain perfection through lust, through their attraction to Krishna. The 10th book describes how the enchanting sound of Krishna's flute would arouse intense romantic feelings, nishamya gitam tadananga vardhanam, in the hearts of the gopis, the cowherd maidens of Raja. When Krishna played his flute in the moonlight, the gopis would go to him in great haste, disregarding all of their duties. The Purana tells us how some of the yogis would be feeding their babies, attending to their husbands, milking the cows, boiling milk, or putting on makeup and ornaments. But when they heard the sound of Krishna's flute, they would stop everything and run to Krishna, despite being prevented by their husbands, brothers, and other relatives. Some of the gopis, however, could not escape from their families and were locked within their homes. Not finding any way to leave, these gopis remained at home in complete absorption, samadhi, on Krishna as their lover. The Bhagavata affirms how both groups of gopis, the gopis who were able to meet Krishna and those who were not, attained perfection in yoga. The gopis who remained home attained perfection through deep meditation, dhyana, on Krishna. Even though these gopis thought of Krishna only as their lover and not as a supreme divinity, their absorption nevertheless connected them with Krishna. The Bhagavata describes that the intense pain that the gopis experienced due to separation, viraha, from Krishna burned tapa off their past karma and freed them of their bodies made of the gunas. The other group of gopis who were able to dance with Krishna in the celebrated Rasa Leela achieved perfection through direct association with Krishna. The Rasa dance is the perfect yoga between the soul and Krishna, and the text suggests that these gopis were given this opportunity because they had already achieved the highest stage of yoga before joining the Rasa dance. However, the Bhagavata posits that even these gopis became more glorified and their yoga became more intensified by association with Krishna. Krishna's touch removes all sins and, quote, destroys sorrow, increases the pleasures of love, and causes people to forget other passions. Due to bathing their senses in the beauty of Krishna and contacting his limbs, the Bhagavata describes, the senses of these gopis became fully purified and overcome with pleasure. The Bhagavata sets this emotional bhakti in the framework of yoga. In the Rasa Leela narrative, the gopis are referred to as yogis, and Krishna as the master of yoga, Yogeshwara, or the master of all masters of yoga, Yogeshwareshwara. Furthermore, the Bhagavata sets the narrative within the same yoga system laid out in the Gita and Yoga Sutra. Hardy points out that the successive activities of the gopis who are unable to meet Krishna resemble the final four stages of yoga found in these texts. Pratyahara, which is withdrawing the senses, dharana, concentration of the mind on a point, dhyana, stability and clarity of mental perception, and samadhi, final liberating insight. So each one of these four stages essentially is the gopis' activities are put in the framework of these successive four stages. When the gopis hear Krishna's flute, they lose all awareness of their surroundings, which is the stage of pratyahara, withdrawing of the senses, and can only think of him, dharana. So then dharana is bringing the form or the object within the mind. Unable to meet Krishna, they intently meditate upon him, dhyana, and finally attain his embrace in their meditation, samadhi. That this is indeed the intent of the author becomes clear later in the text, when one of the gopis who meets Krishna is described as a yogi. For although Krishna stands before her, the gopi closes her eyes and embraces Krishna in meditation. Quote, some other woman, drawing Krishna in her heart through the apertures of her eyes and then sealing them shut, stood embracing him in her heart like a yogi immersed in bliss. Unquote. Thus, it is clear that the Bhagavata views the gopis as accomplished yogis, and their yoga of emotional bhakti resembles the Eightfold Yoga. For the Yoga Sutra, the content of one's concentration, dharana, is not very important. It is the act of dharana itself that produces wonderful powers. For the Bhagavata, however, the object of meditation is of great significance. Dharana is not the self-awareness of the Purusha, devoid of content. The object and experience of dhyana in the Purana is the eternal and beautiful form and lila of Krishna. So, going back to the initial meanings, you could say the literal meanings of the word yoga, we said that yoga meant control, or it meant connect. So the Gita and the Yoga Sutras tend to use it more in the sense of control, that yoga is a practice of harnessing the senses, controlling the senses. They emphasize more on that meaning, you could say. And the Bhagavata seems to emphasize more on the aspect of connect, that yoga is the heart of yoga is connection of the self connecting its senses with Krishna or with the divine. So the object of dharana, or the object of the dhyana, is of key importance to the Bhagavata, because who the yogi is connecting with, or what the yogi is connecting with, is of great importance. Hardy lists 25 verses that show that all the mental, emotional, and psychic processes of the gopis are concentrated on Krishna. At various places throughout the text, the Bhagavata describes the gopis' mind, heart, intellect, consciousness, hope, and body are all absorbed in Krishna. Quote, "The women of Raja, singing to each other about Krishna's lila, passed the days happily. The hearts and minds of those fortunate women were absorbed in Krishna." Unquote. This is significantly different from the state of samadhi described in the Yoga Sutra, which is isolation, free from the fluctuations of the mind, kaivalya. The state of samadhi envisioned by the Bhagavata is not isolation, kaivalya, or liberation, moksha, which are goals of yoga found in the Gita and the Yoga Sutra. Indeed, the Purana concludes its discussion by rejecting all five types of liberation, including oneness, ekatva. Thus, the yoga of the Bhagavata is steeped in emotional bhakti. This emotional yoga is displayed within the Lord's play with his devotees, and its highest expression is found in the relationship between the gopis and Krishna. Although the Gita and Bhagavata both prescribe bhakti, the Rasa Lila narrative shows that the Bhagavata's bhakti is performed by connecting rather than controlling the senses. Hardy confirms this, quote, "This is wherein lies the difference from the intellectual bhakti. The senses are essential and primary means to let Krishna's sensuous and sensual beauty captivate the mind. It is quite clear that it is Krishna's physical, sensual appearance, his beauty, which entrances the girls, and not any abstract philosophical concept." Unquote. The Bhagavata's bhakti involves transforming the focus of the mind and senses rather than shutting them down. By immersing the mind and senses in Krishna, one automatically controls them. For the Purana, focusing the senses on Krishna is the highest meditation and goal of life, because those who do enter for certain into his state of being. The sensuous yoga of the Rasa Lila, can take place by the arrangement and the sensuous yoga of the Rasa Lila dance can take place, however, by the arrangement and supervision of Krishna's yoga maya. In the Bhagavad Gita, yoga maya is the power generated from Krishna's yoga, which bewilders all beings. This power is fully under Krishna's control, and it is the power through which Krishna controls others. In the Bhagavata, yoga maya is also generated from Krishna's yoga, but because yoga is primarily seen as emotional bhakti, yoga maya's primary role becomes arranging an intimate connection between the yogi and Yogeshwara. So yoga maya also becomes the tool for connecting the yogi and the Yogeshwara. A distinct feature of the Bhagavata's conception of yoga maya, therefore, is that both the yogis, the gopis, and Yogeshwara, Krishna, become connected and controlled by yoga maya, just as two bulls are controlled by a yoke. the power of Yogamaya, the yogi and Yogeshwara, by the power of Yogamaya, the yogi and Yogeshwara attain the state of perfect yoga, the Rasa Lila. Let us now take a closer look at the ways in which Yogamaya orchestrates the connection between Krishna and the gopis and intensifies bhakti within the Rasa Lila. The five chapters of the Rasa Lila vividly illustrate Yogamaya's unique function in the Bhagavad Purana. So now, quickly, I'll just look at a few examples of practically how Yogamaya acts or functions within the yoga of the Bhagavata. And this is quite... this is very unique to the Bhagavata. This is very original in some ways. Right from the first verse, Yogamaya makes her presence known in the Rasa Lila. Quote, "Even the beloved Lord, seeing those nights in autumn filled with blooming jasmine flowers, turned his mind towards love's delights, fully taking refuge in Yogamaya's elusive powers." The word Yogamaya appears only once, and the unqualified term Maya appears only twice in the five chapters of the Rasa Lila. Nevertheless, it is significant that Yogamaya appears in the opening verse of the narrative, for it suggests that Yogamaya plays a crucial role in the Rasa Lila. As we will see, this indeed is the case. Even though the text explicitly refers to Maya only three times, it emphasizes the important role of Krishna's yogic power by frequently referring to Krishna as a master of yoga, Yogeshwara. Among the many events that take place in the Rasa Lila, Yogamaya is particularly responsible for drawing Krishna and the gopis together for their performance of yoga. Yogamaya plays this role in the opening verse by facilitating Krishna's desire for play, but we already begin to see her instrumental role several chapters before the Rasa Lila. There we find the gopis worshipping Yogamaya, known as the goddess Katyayani or Arya, for a month in order to get Krishna as their husband. So this is before the Rasa Lila, when the gopis are hoping to get Krishna as their husband, because they know, well, one of them will get Krishna as their husband. So they all want Krishna as their husband, so they worship the goddess Katyayani, who is also known as Yogamaya in the text. In the first month of the Hemanta winter season, the young girls of Nanda's Vraj observe the vow of worship to worship the goddess Katyayani by eating sacrificial food. After bathing in the waters of the Kalindi River at sunrise, they made an image of the goddess from sand near the water and prayed, "O goddess Katyayani, great Maya, great yogi, honor to you, please make the son of Nanda, the Gopa, my husband, O goddess." Uttering this mantra, those young girls perform puja, worship. Unquote. When the gopis have successfully completed their vows, Krishna assures them that because of their worship, their desires will be fulfilled in the following nights. The nights, kshapaha, prophesied by Krishna refer to the nights of the Rasa Lila, which will take place a few days later, thanks to the connecting power of Yogamaya. The fact that both Krishna and the gopis seek refuge in Yogamaya to fulfill their union yoga is no coincidence. Here we see Yogamaya's essential role of yoking together the yogi and Yogeshwara for an intimate emotional exchange. Another way in which Yogamaya intensifies bhakti is by causing the devotee to forget Krishna's majesty. Yogamaya has a similar function in both the material and transcendent worlds. Yogamaya has a similar function in both the material and transcendent worlds, to make souls forget the greatness of God. But while in the material worlds, Yogamaya distances the soul from God, in the transcendent realm of Krishna's Lila, she connects the two intimately. Yogamaya makes Krishna's devotee forget that he is God, allowing him to act as a human child. So one function that Yogamaya plays is to make the devotee forget that Krishna is God, so that the lila, so that this emotional bhakti can take place. But the Rasa Lila narrative takes Yogamaya's role even further, for the text seems to suggest that even Krishna submits to Maya. In this unique Leela, Yogamaya not only makes the devotee forget the majesty of God, but she also enables God to forget his own majesty. For if God remembers that he is God, how can he enjoy intimate relationships? The Bhagavata uses the metaphor of actors in a drama. Just as actors and actresses voluntarily forget their real identities while playing their role, Krishna and his devotees voluntarily forget their identities as master and servant in loving play. Krishna is the author of the play, the creator of the stage, Rasa Mandala, on which the play is enacted, and the best actor, losing himself completely in the play. Yogamaya arranges the stage sets and directs the play. And then I'll read one more example here, and then we'll end with that. Yogamaya also facilitates emotional bhakti by creating magical events which enhance and intensify the ecstatic play of the Rasa Leela. Krishna dances with many gopis whose number the Bhagavata does not specify. By his Yogamaya, Krishna multiplies himself so that he can dance with each gopi and their senses can come in touch with him. Quote, the festival of the Rasa dance commenced with a circular formation of gopis. The Supreme Lord of Yoga, Yogeshwara, Krishna, entered among them between each pair. Each thought she alone was at his side as he placed his arms around the necks of those young women. Although the text does not refer to Yogamaya directly, it describes Krishna as Yogeshwara, the master of yoga. We have already seen the strong connection between yoga and Maya in the Bhagavata, especially in situations where yogi harnesses his yoga, his Maya, to perform extraordinary feats. Given that the text attributes Krishna's self-multiplication to his mastery of yoga, the presence of yoga Maya is unmistakable. In his commentary on this verse, Vishwanatha also reads yoga as yoga Maya. Quote, the word yoga can refer to yoga Maya, the great potency, who is expert in doing the impossible for her Lord Sri Krishna. Knowing that Krishna desired to embrace all the gopis simultaneously, Yogamaya manifested in Krishna for each gopi to solve this problem. By multiplying himself in many forms, Krishna is able to dance with each gopi hand in hand. Krishna's touch brings about the characteristic bodily changes of emotional bhakti found in the Bhagavata, such as eruptions on the skin, weeping, sweating, and hair standing on end. As a result of Yogamaya's facilitation, not only does Krishna appear on the side of each gopi, but each gopi thinks that she alone was at his side. This increases the intensity of the gopi's love, because each gopi thinks that Krishna is especially favoring her. Here again, we see Yogamaya's central role in intensifying bhakti. So, actually, quite interestingly, the Vishnu Puran also has a description of the Rasa Leela. And in that description, and in other descriptions that we find before the Bhagavata, we don't find this aspect of Krishna multiplying himself in many forms in order to dance with each gopi. And nor do we find in these other narrations of the same act or same drama, you could say, we don't find the Yogamaya playing this role. We don't find Yogamaya mentioned in these descriptions. So, with its sort of conception of Yogamaya and this development of Yogamaya, the Bhagavata adds many things to this to the Rasa Leela narrative as a way of enhancing its. Its description of bhakti, its description of the Rasa Leela. So I think I'll stop at this point.
Thank you very much.
And
well, thank you, Gopal, for a very interesting and engaging survey of this material. So we've got half an hour for discussion and questions.
Yes.
In your discussion or the relation between yoga and Maya in the Mahabharata, you told us the story. I was writing my thoughts down as you were telling the story, so I kind of missed half of it. But there was something with a lake in.
Yes.
And what was that story?
Basically, at the end of the battle when everyone has been killed except for about a dozen people. The five Pandavas are left. Krishna is there, and on the other side, only Duryodhan is left, and a few of his men, like Ashwatthama and like that. So Duryodhan has lost the side of the Kauravas, and Duryodhan is the head of that side. Duryodhan has lost everything. He doesn't have any weapons. He doesn't have any people left. So he's now the only one left to be killed. So in order to escape from the Pandavas, he goes to a lake and he hides at the bottom of that lake. And well, normally you couldn't hide at the bottom of a lake, but he's able to do that because he's an accomplished yogi. He's able to do that because of his mayic powers. And then in addition to doing that, just so if he is found in the lake, the Pandavas are not able to come inside the lake, he solidifies that entire lake and makes it solid. And the normal person couldn't break it, essentially. And so when the Pandavas and Krishna finally locate that lake, then Krishna tells Yudhishthira that with your powers of Maya, melt this lake so it becomes water again, so we can get him out of the lake.
I heard the last part.
I see.
That made, but the relationship between the two, particularly when you described a few of the occasions of people doing yoga as being fairly ascetic in nature, and it made me think of tapas, actually, where tapas is sort of both the act itself, but also the result, that the power that one obtains through tapas, which is of course also something that you see in the Bhagavata itself, where some of the people in the Bhagavata have a particular practice, and that leads to tapas. And it made me think, well, if Maya is related to yoga, how is all of that related to tapas, and where does tapas, you know, is it something similar, is it something different? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Definitely in the Vedas, the Rig Veda and Yajur, and those initial texts, tapas is just essentially it's a practice of austerity. It's not connected with yoga, because yoga as a meditative and an austere practice like tapas is a later development. In other words, yoga is not used in that sense in earlier literature. Now, in terms of the Mahabharata, tapas and yoga are quite similar in many situations, because also David White, in his recent book on yoga, he's also making the point that the original usage of yoga, or the original way yoga is used, is as possession. You know, yoga gives control, it gives possession over powers. So if tapas is doing the same thing, then essentially yoga and tapas are quite similar. Now, the way it may be different is that yoga also has a very... bhakti does exist in the Mahabharata as well. The term bhakti yoga is used in the Gita. Karma yoga is used there. Buddhi yoga is used there. So it's also seen as a method of action. You know, yoga is also a method of practice, a method of action for liberation. So that aspect is definitely also there, and has been developed in the Mahabharata. But yeah, the Mahabharata is in some ways using the standard usage of yoga, as yoga as possession and as control, but then is also using yoga in these ways as karma yoga and buddhi yoga, which is a new development in some ways for the Mahabharata. So and what exactly the relationship between those two terms are in the Mahabharata, that is interesting.
Or in the Bhagavata,
yes. Yes. The Bhagavata, it doesn't talk that much about tapas, because it does talk about different types of yoga, like Jada yoga, where the yogi pulls out hair from his head, and talks about, and it generally always, all these activities that are characteristic of tapas, it generally just makes them a type of yoga. And because it's greatly preoccupied with bhakti, it doesn't discuss tapas that much, maybe in a few passages. Yes.
Just if I understood you. Mm. Did you make a distinction between the Bhagavad Purana and the Bhagavad Gita in their usage of yoga? The Bhagavad Gita using it more in terms of its as a controlling force to control your senses, and as a yoga that to by disciplining, reining in senses, one will achieve various positive results.
Mm.
And the Bhagavad Purana more connection, is like as in meditation.
Mm.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I was just, and I know Freedom Hardy has to say on that about more intellectual bhakti, and, but I'm wondering if that's perhaps oversimplified, and just questioning that, because I'm thinking of chapter 6, which is the most focused on yoga in the Gita, and then it ends at the final verse of chapter 6 is yoginamapi sarvesham madgatanantar atmana, the idea that, well, the best yogi is the one who meditates or is like connecting to me.
Yes.
And there are others like that, many others, and I'm just wondering if it's selective choice, that you could just select controlling, and you could equally select ones that are about actual connecting rather than controlling.
Yes. Definitely, Hardy's classification of the Gita's bhakti as intellectual bhakti and the Bhagavata as emotional bhakti, I too felt it's definitely a simplification, because the bhakti, many forms of, the Gita also talks about yoga in the context of devotion, which is not exactly intellectual. What I think Hardy is trying to say, and where there is a very major gap between the Gita's yoga and the Bhagavata's yoga, is that the result of yoga in the Bhagavata, aside from even the gopis, but just in terms of yogic practice, when it describes yogis, is that these yogis, as a result of their yoga, they have tears coming down their eyes, and hairs are standing on their end, and they're rolling on the ground as a result of their yoga. So that type of emotional bhakti or emotional yoga is missing in the Gita. That's not there in the Gita. Because in the Bhagavata, in the third book, the Bhagavata somewhat systematically presents the eight levels of Patanjali's yoga, the Eightfold Yoga. And in that, it's talking about the different postures and all these things. But even in that discussion, the final state of samadhi is described. Okay, you know you're in samadhi when, as a result of your yoga, tears are coming down your eyes. So, so the yoga of the Gita definitely has bhakti involved in it. Bhakti is seen as, like the verse that you quoted, is seen as one of the best forms of yoga. But it hasn't fully reached an emotional state. It's still devotion in the sense of knowing that this is the right thing to do. It's the right thing to love God, not in some ways that the senses are automatically being drawn towards your object.
Yes, I mean, I agree. Sorry. Further slightly questioning that, I agree it's perhaps much more implicit in the Bhagavad Gita. But then at the end, the Bhagavad Gita does culminate in this sort of horripilation as well, whereby Sanjaya says, I'm so struck with this wonderful narration of Krishna that my hair is standing on end, and you get this very emotional result in the end. You get this kind of dun-da-da-da.
Yes.
You know, so it's... it's not devoid of emotion. I totally agree with you in terms of explicit narrative. There's no comparison, but I just wonder if it's skipped over a little.
That's a very interesting point, because the seeds of the Bhagavata's theology and philosophy, you could say, are found in the Mahabharata, and like we were reading in the beginning, the Puranas, they take Sankhya, Yoga, Bhakti, these different schools of thought, and they develop on it. They sort of choose one and say, oh, this is the best, and now let's develop on it. So, here we're just speaking about the Gita. I'm sure in the Mahabharata in general, there's probably even more instances of bhakti that's overflowing, and that's the Pandavas, and specifically Arjuna's affection towards Krishna is a good example as well, where that's suggesting an emotional form of bhakti. So that's something that's very valid.
Nick Sutton wrote an article on a passage where it talks about devotion in the Mahabharata of devotion to Shiva, And it's very, very sort of all the characteristics that Fred Hardy would ascribe to emotional bhakti are right there. And it's a passage that, I mean, it made it into the critical edition, whatever that means. But it's generally not considered sort of a later interpolation into the text. But yeah, it's kind of, but there it's towards Shiva. It's I forget the exact context, but somebody's worshipping Shiva and devotion, and has all this sort of very physical experience of that devotion.
Yes, that would be interesting to see. I'd like to see that.
There was a lot of in this material you presented of what you might call variable indexicality, where you've got the devotees or whoever, the gopis, or being forgetting themselves or losing themselves, so they're being overwhelmed by a different eye. So their indexical eye, if you like, is being overwhelmed by the eye of the text or the eye of discourse or something. And I was wondering about the relationship between the text and its community of reception. Would it be used liturgically, as it were? Who's reading that? Are they reciting it, or who's reading it?
This gets into the sociology of the Bhagavatam. In some words, what was the social
if we know
scene,
anything.
Yes, of the Bhagavatam, when it was composed, and also how does the Bhagavatam present its own sociology, its own idea of a social system. And what's very interesting in the Bhagavata is that the Bhagavata is definitely trying to go to do something a bit radical, to try to go against the orthodox understandings of that day. Because just in terms of an overview of the Bhagavata, one sees that all the role models or the heroes of the Bhagavata are types of people that you wouldn't expect in a normal Sanskrit, a normal Brahminical text. The highest devotees are described as gopis, which are women. And they're not even the wives of brahmanas, but they're milkmaids. They're vaishya women or shudra women. So the Bhagavata there, for its time, it's making a very serious statement, which scholars have noticed that and it can't be underestimated, that for its time it's elevating women to the highest devotees, to the most perfect beings. And there's specific verses in the Bhagavata specifically say that, well, the perfection that Krishna's mother Yashoda attained was not even achieved by the gods like Brahma and Shiva and the great sages. So it's explicitly trying to make the point that these people are even better than the normal normal people who are seen as the best of yogis. Then you find that whenever there's a conflict between, in most narratives, when there's a conflict between the asuras and the suras, as the normal narratives go, the suras do the demigods, the gods as like smaller gods like Indra and Varuna and these things, which the Bhagavata sees as specific gods for specific purposes. These gods, they attain victory over the asuras. They attain victory, and they attain. The story goes just as it's supposed to, but the asuras are always the ones who actually attain victory, because they're the ones who, as a result of defeat, attain great insight, like in the case of Rikasura, Ritasura, that Indra still wins, like the Rig Veda describes, or like the other texts describe, but Ritasura in this case actually wins, because he's the one who gains all this insight that actually in defeat there's victory in defeat. And he points out to Indra that all of you are just into your opulence and into your worldly pleasures, which pass away in a flickering time of a moment, but we, on the other hand, by losing, have actually realized the true nature of this world. So again, the Bhagavata wants to portray as the asuras as being better than the gods, because you know they're not the normal, you know, the normal good people that you would expect.
Sorry, who claims that again?
The Bhagavata is presenting it this way, yes. Yeah. Similarly, one of the role models for the Bhagavata is Prahlad, who's the son of a demon. Right? So he's worse than a Shudra, but he's the ideal Vaishnava character. So again, it's making a very serious social, making a social message there. So the Bhagavata in general, it adheres to the standard norms of dharma that are laid out in the Mahabharata and in the dharma shastras. It adheres to them, but then it modifies that dharma or sort of redefines that dharma within the context of bhakti. So it says, okay, the dharma, and this especially happens in the context of the gopis, it says the dharma of a woman is to serve her husband and to not go to any other man and to be chaste to her husband. But the gopis, many times it refers to them as the most chaste women. But in the context of bhakti, well, who is the real husband? Well, the real husband is the supreme soul, that's Krishna. So therefore they are the most chaste women. And so therefore what they're doing is the best of all. So it won't disagree with the normal dharma because it's not accepted by social norms. It cannot do that. But it sort of redefines it in the context of bhakti. This is a far leap from the dharma shastras, which say that, you know, if a shudra happens to recite the Vedas, then you cut off his tongue. If he happens to hear the Vedas, then you pour lead into his ears. Whereas in the Mahabharata, some of the Vaishnava role models are shudras and even animals, like Gajendra. You know, he's an elephant, and even the animals attain perfection. So what to speak of the lower caste shudras and the women? So it's who it was specifically speaking to, I don't exactly know, but it's definitely trying to create a wave. Or trying to present something different.
You mentioned David White's work in relation to it, where he talks about possession and so on. In a sense, you can see the gopis in this, the narrative, as being possessed by Krishna in a sense, but do you think that that's a useful way of looking at it? Is the word possession a useful way of looking at this material? Does it use the term avesha in your text, or aruda?
Yes. It uses the word avesha. That word is used, like we discussed, the specific metaphor. The Bhagavata tends to explain things through metaphor. So the metaphor that it gives is like actors in a drama. So they're possessed by it, but at the same time, the Bhagavata wants to hold on that in the liberated stage, in the stage of perfection, in terms of the gopis. And in terms of Krishna, it's a voluntary possession. So they want to be possessed by yoga maya. And actually, in terms of that, I have one. Another nice example for this is later on in the 10th book, when Krishna is in Dvarka, then Narada, he visits Dvarka, and he's there in Dvarka also. Krishna uses his yoga maya to expand himself in 16,000 forms, because he has 16,000 wives. So with each wife, he has one palace and one form. So Narada can see this, others cannot, because maya doesn't allow others to see that this is happening. But he can see this, and so then becoming susceptible to the influence of maya is a desirable situation. In the Rasa Lila narrative, maya is a power that intensifies bhakti and increases the joys of love. Succumbing to the influence of maya is the highest attainment of life and the goal of yoga. Later in the 10th book, when Krishna is in Dvarka, Narada observes how Krishna multiplies himself in 16,000 forms and builds as many palaces by his yoga maya to consort with each one of his wives. Narada is awestruck and makes the following remark. Quote, "We know that your yoga maya is hard to perceive, but it will become manifest O soul of the lords of yoga, by service to your lotus feet. While in other sections of the Bhagavata, yoga is performed to free a person from the undesirable influence of yoga maya. In the 10th book, the practice of yoga allows the yogi entrance into the world of Krishna's maya. Once in Krishna's world, yoga maya intensifies the yogi's yoga and allows the yogi to experience emotional bhakti. So this is like a very interesting contrast, because in the beginning of the Bhagavata sort of starts out with, okay, maya is a fundamental human problem. The selves are struggling in this web of maya. They've been possessed by maya beyond their control, as sort of and so actually it's a very nice way of illustrating maya, that in the worldly realm, in the samsaric realm, the souls are controlled by maya. They're possessed by it. And so that's how the Bhagavata begins its description of maya. But then, starting the 10th book, it says, well, no, if you practice yoga, you can actually become overcome by maya, by Krishna's maya, and this maya is actually a good one. This one is something which is something that allows you to forget yourself in the play with Krishna. And in the 10th book, we also find that the gopis are going in and out of this possession, you could say, in and out of this forgetfulness. So when they're in touch with Krishna, they forget that he's God and they think of him as his lover. And so in some ways, like the emotion overcomes their knowledge, and they're just, you know, they're into that specific rasa dance. But when Krishna, for example, leaves them, he disappears from their sight, or they're not seeing him, then the Bhagavata portrays them as offering prayers to Krishna. And in that they mention, you know, you are the source of all the worlds and you're the supreme lord and this and that. So in that sense, it's slightly different from possession also, in that it's a possession when needed in some ways. They go in and out of this influence of yoga maya.
I got another question actually. It's really interesting. So when they're gopis, they leave a chaya, they leave a shadow of themselves with their husbands, go off to be with Krishna. That's maya then, that's an illusion. So is it saying that the whole world is like that? So is the world real then in this text?
Is that Gopal at all?
Is it real? Yes.
So it's
real. That's actually a very good point, because this specific incident that Gavin is referring to is when the gopis leave their husbands. Yogamaya, not only does Yogamaya expand Krishna in many forms, but it makes a double for each gopi, the chaya, essentially the you could say the reflection or the shadow of the gopis stays behind with their husbands, and their husbands are consorting in some ways with the material the forms of the gopis, and the gopis themselves go in their bodies which are free from the gunas which the Bhagavata describes. So their bodies made of matter essentially are described as a shadow or a reflection. Now this is the same metaphor that the Bhagavata uses in relation to the world, that the physical world, the world of matter, is like a reflection, is an abhasa or a chaya of the true reality. So now the Bhagavata, it was written before Shankara, so it's not a fully Advaitin text. It's not giving an Advaita philosophy. So it is saying that the world, it's not saying that the world is unreal, but it's real in the sense that it's a reflection. That's the extent to which it is real. So the Bhagavata also uses the metaphor of reflection. But the Bhagavata sees a reflection as something that is real because it's an object of experience. But it's real only in the sense that it's a reflection. And it's real in this, and it's unreal in the sense that it's temporary. So a reflection comes and goes. A reflection is something that, is transitory and misleading and delusive and bewildering. So the world is all these things. And precisely because it is these things, because it is an illusion and a reflection, it's real, but it's a lower reality. It's something that is unwanted and deceiving.
Did the Buddhists ever get hold of this? It's very interesting. Any other points before we fold up? Well, thanks, Gopal, for sharing with us your work. It's really very interesting, and you presented it in a very clear way, so thank you.
Thank you very much for your attendance and feedback. It's very helpful for me in terms of my writing of my thesis.